Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, July 20th, 2025. This program was previously broadcast on January 26th, 2025. From the December 2024 issue of Scientific American, A Question and Answer with Troy Hunt, written by Ben Guarino, who is an associate technology editor at Scientific American. What giant data breaches mean for you? Expert advice for protecting sensitive data. At some point in the past year, one or more hackers quietly breached a background-checking company called National Public Data, NPD, and exposed millions of U.S. Social Security numbers, names, phone numbers, and email and mailing addresses. The accuracy and significance of some of these data, much of which NPD had probably scraped from public governmental records, is questionable. The reality of the leak itself is not. In August, NPD acknowledged an incident involving a third-party bad actor that was trying to hack into data in late December 2023. According to a notice on the data aggregating company's website, the stolen information appears to have been put up for sale online beginning in the spring. It is deeply unpleasant to imagine social security numbers and other sensitive information circulating like so much digital plankton among the web's darker currents. And what is spilled out can't be recalled. So what does one do when this happens? You can freeze your credit, preventing anyone from opening a new credit account in your name until the freeze is lifted, via the major reporting bureaus. The three main agencies used in the U.S. are Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. Such an incident offers a sobering reminder to practice good password hygiene going forward. Don't reuse passwords. Their complexity and uniqueness are powerful. And consider a manager such as 1Password. Americans can check whether their social security number was exposed via a tool such as Pentester's NPD Breach Check. At the website Have I Been Pwned, launched by Australia-based online security consultant Troy Hunt in 2013, visitors can see whether their email addresses have been exposed in data breaches. An offshoot project similarly evaluates passwords. In its decade plus of existence, Have I Been Pwned has ballooned to include 6 billion unique email addresses. Each account has been breached slightly more than twice on average. I had no idea it would become big. I wouldn't have given it such a stupid name, Hunt says. To pwn, pronounced pwn as a pun on own someone, is to utterly defeat them. Per internet slang that enjoyed a heyday in the early 2000s and was used by online gamers. Besides meaning to utterly defeat an opponent, it also means to take unauthorized control of someone's computer hardware or, say, an email account. As Hunt puts it, the risk of a data breach is simply a cold reality that comes with being online. If the internet is the information superhighway, leaks are among the roadside wreckage. It's terrible that we have a road toll, and objectives towards zero are fantastic, he says. But while we hurtle around at 100 kilometers an hour in metal machines, this is what's going to happen. Hunt talked with Scientific American about how to make sense of the potentially alarming amount of data involved in massive breaches, and what an increasingly online world means for our private information. An edited transcript of the conversation follows. Some major data breaches have been revealed this year, such as the AT&T breach, which exposed data from 73 million former and current customers. More recently, there was this National Public Data fiasco. One clear difference between those breaches is that NPD was this little-known data aggregator that sells services such as background checks, not a big familiar corporation. Maybe there's no blueprint for what a standard data breach is. But you tell me, is this an unusual case? I'm looking at the list of the big breaches in the Have I Been Pwned database, and often they are from the likes of data aggregators. People don't know who data aggregators are. Most of us, I think, are not too keen on the idea of data aggregation. We don't like the idea of organizations siphoning up and monetizing our data without our knowledge or informed consent. I'll add that caveat. When an incident like this happens, it's quite frustrating for people because they're going, who is this organization? Why do they have my data? What can I do? And really, you don't have any recourse. There are a few standard suggestions for what to do after a breach, such as placing freezes with credit reporting bureaus and making sure your passwords are robust. Is there anything else people should be doing? There's no discrete thing you can do directly about this kind of incident. It's not like when infidelity dating website Ashley Madison got breached, where you should change your password and probably have a conversation with your spouse or partner. In this case, it's all the fundamental stuff you really should be doing anyway. You should have whatever freezes you have available on credit until you actually need to apply for it. For identity theft monitoring services, you have to spend some money, but it's not a bad idea. And then, of course, use strong, unique passwords and multi-factor authentication. Then just have that consciousness of what are the things you should be looking for out there that might indicate these data are being abused. Phone calls from a bank, for example, asking about an application you've made that you have no idea about. The guidance doesn't change because of this breach. It just reinforces it. There were rumors of the NPD breach trickling around for a few months before it percolated into the mainstream media. When it first hit, some of the headlines described 2.9 billion hacked accounts, which was off base. The breach actually appears to consist of 2.9 billion or so rows of data. Also complicating matters, bad actors behind a leak or sale might not be trustworthy. They'll boast and inflate file sizes or combine already exposed data from multiple breaches to make a leak look huge. How should we think critically about big, scary numbers in headlines about data breaches? We've seen this so many times before. Over the summer, we were seeing headlines of the biggest password dump ever, which had 10 billion records. But when bad actors include every word from the dictionary and every combination of it, does the average person have to worry about it? No. Earlier this year, there was another one going around. It's called the mother of all breaches. That was 20 billion records or something. Well, it's just that someone siphoned up a whole bunch of breaches and put them all together. Add one more, and now you've got the biggest mother of all breaches. By the same token, the truth is always there in the data. The number of records in total is an important figure, but without the context of what this actually means, it's hard to understand it. So I think a much fairer metric is how many people are impacted. And clearly, if it's just U.S. Social Security numbers, it's going to be in the low hundreds of millions at the absolute upper limit. Do we know for sure that every American Social Security number is in the NPD breach? No, we don't know that for sure. Investigative journalist Brian Krebs has written some good stuff about this. There are lots of different places where these data might be published, and then they all get aggregated together. If you haven't, for example, been arrested or ended up in a public record somewhere, then you may not be in there. The thing that really frustrates me about this is that clearly NPD had a breach. I don't think there's any question about that anymore. And when you look at its disclosure notice, there's basically nothing there. The company has really given us nothing of any substance. Editor's note, Scientific American repeatedly emailed NPD to ask whether it had taken additional actions to contact affected individuals. The company did not respond. In a recorded message on its breach hotline, NPD says it, quote, "will try to notify you if there are further significant developments applicable to you," unquote. You wrote about lackluster corporate disclosure in a June blog post entitled, The State of Data Breaches. People might be surprised to know that data breach laws can have exceptions related to notification. In Florida, where NPD is based, if a security breach involves more than 500,000 people, what is legally sufficient is a motive, quote, in print and to broadcast media, unquote, and, quote, a conspicuous notice on the internet website of the covered entity, unquote. How would you improve disclosure? Disclosure doesn't necessarily mean letting the individuals know. It's usually disclosure to the regulator unless we're talking about sensitive personal information, health data, for example. The carve-out in Australia is that there's got to be a likelihood of causing serious harm. The Florida situation, like you just mentioned, is a notice. California's got the California Consumer Privacy Act, but I believe even under that, companies can still decide whether or not to notify individuals in the vast majority of cases. There are all of these people who get pissed when they don't get told, like really, really pissed, understandably. And I'm sitting here at Have I Been Pwned going, well, I've got your data, I can let you know. But it shouldn't be my job, right? I should be completely redundant because organizations should notify people early. You've worked in Have I Been Pwned for more than a decade, but let's look ahead. Where are data breaches headed in the next 10 years? If you think about the factors that lead to data breaches or amplify data breaches, we'll have more people, we'll have more systems, we'll have more devices that have data. We've seen a lot of Internet of Things related data breaches. There are data collected from cloud pet toys, teddy bears that talk in Have I Been Pwned. We're also going down a path where we're seeing a lot of breaches, such as all the ones from this year related to cloud data storage company Snowflake, where we're dependent on external services that a flaw or a practice on behalf of threat actors can get reapplied over and over and over again to everyone using that particular platform. So all these factors combine to amplify the problems we're having now. In summary, I think it's getting worse. And this interview between Ben Guarino, an associate technology editor of Scientific American, and security consultant Troy Hunt, who created the website Have I Been Pwned, appears in the December 2024 issue of Scientific American. And now for two New York Times trilobites. First, posted on January 13, 2025, Mummies' Ancient Tattoos Come Under Laser Focus. With a tool often used in the study of dinosaur fossils, scientists uncovered new details in ornate tattoos on the skin of members of the Chancay culture of Peru. By Becky Ferreira. A culture flourished along the central Peruvian coast from about AD 900 to 1500. Called the Chancay, they left behind a wealth of cultural remains, including intricate tattoos that are preserved to this day on the skin of mummified individuals. New details of these tattoos that were previously hidden to the naked eye, including finely traced lines, were described in a study published a few weeks ago. After illuminating the mummies with laser-stimulated fluorescence, or LSF, an imaging tool that until now had never been applied to tattoos, scientists discovered lines 0.1 to 0.2 millimeters wide, narrower than work produced by most modern tattoo needles. We were shocked by just how fine the tattoo lines were in our LSF images, said Michael Pittman, an assistant professor at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, and an author of the new study in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, in an email. We immediately knew that what we were seeing was special. The mummies featured in the new study had been buried at the Cerro Colorado Cemetery and were rediscovered in 1981. Their tattoos are roughly 1,000 years old and display ornate geometric designs, reminiscent of scales or vines, as well as an amorphous animal with a curled tail. The Chankai have long been known for high levels of craftsmanship across their material culture and left elaborate markings in far more than their tattoos, said Aaron Dieter Wolf, a prehistoric archaeologist at the Tennessee Division of Archaeology who specializes in ancient tattoos and was not involved in this study. Dr. Pittman, a dinosaur paleobiologist, has spent more than a decade probing fossils with laser-stimulated fluorescence. This non-invasive tool exposes specimens to high-powered lasers, producing a fluorescent glow that sometimes reveals subtle features, like soft tissues. In recent years, Dr. Pittman's team has started exploring the archaeological applications of the new technique. We expect LSF to work on other ancient tattoos from different cultures around the world and have plans to continue this imaging work to uncover similarly exciting discoveries, Dr. Pittman said. Hopefully, we can push back the complexity of ancient tattoos even further back in time. Mr. Dieter Wolf was not convinced that the study demonstrated clear advantages of LSF over other techniques for scrutinizing ancient tattoos, such as multispectral imaging. This is a cool additional tool in our kit, but it's not groundbreaking, he said. He also had concerns about some of the study's conclusions. Dr. Pittman's team suggested in the study that the tattoo patterns were made from punctures by a fine instrument, like a cactus needle or sharpened animal bone. Mr. Dieter Wolf believes that most tattoos examined in the study were made with incisions, not punctures. A painter uses different paintbrushes to achieve different results, he said. Tattooists have done that same thing for thousands of years, so depending on the tool that they're using, you will get a different physical signature as a result. Dr. Pittman stood by his team's conclusion that the tattoos were made by puncture. The unique thinness of our tattoo lines among published Chankai tattoos suggests a needle-based production, puncture tattooing, is more reasonable, he said in an email. Pinning down the methods that tattooists used is an important step in interpreting the meaning of body art to past societies. A range of techniques were used across cultures, and the processing of making body art was often imbued with ritual significance. For instance, Ötzi, a 5,300-year-old iceman with the oldest known body art on a mummy, may have been inked primarily for therapeutic reasons rather than just aesthetics. While it's natural to wonder why the Chankai took such pains with their work, their motivations remain a mystery. These are not purely artistic expressions, Mr. Dieter Wolf said. They are very culturally loaded. The tattoo is the tip of the iceberg, he noted, but there's this whole cultural framework that underlies it. This New York Times trilobite, Mummies Ancient Tattoos Come Under Laser Focus, was posted on January 13, 2025. Ötzi, a 5,300-year-old iceman with the oldest known body art on a mummy, may have been inked primarily for therapeutic reasons. Well, who was Ötzi? From Wikipedia, Ötzi, also called the Iceman, is the natural mummy of a man who lived between 3350 and 3105 BC. His remains were discovered on September 19, 1991, in the Uetzel Alps, hence the nickname Ötzi, at the Austria-Italy border. He is Europe's oldest known natural human mummy, offering an unprecedented view of the Copper Age, Europeans. Because of the presence of an arrowhead embedded in his left shoulder and various other wounds, researchers believe that Ötzi was killed by another person. The nature of his life and the circumstances of his death are the subject of much investigation and speculation. His remains and personal belongings are on exhibit at the South Tyrol Museum of Archaeology in Bolzano, South Tyrol, Italy. He was found by two German tourists at an elevation of 10,530 feet on the east ridge of the Finalspitze in the Uetzel Alps at the Austrian-Italian border. When the tourists first saw the body, they both believed they had happened upon a recently deceased mountaineer. The next day, a mountain gendarme and the keeper of the nearby hut first attempted to remove the body, which was frozen in ice below the torso, using a pneumatic drill and ice axes, but bad weather forced them to give up. The body was finally extracted on September 22nd and salvaged the following day. It was transported to the office of the medical examiner in Innsbruck, together with other objects found nearby. On September 24th, the find was examined by an archaeologist, Konrad Spindler, of the University of Innsbruck. Tissue samples from the corpse and other accompanying materials were later analyzed at several scientific institutions, and their results unequivocally concluded that the remains belonged to someone who had lived some 5,000 years ago. The corpse has been extensively examined, measured, x-rayed, and dated. Tissues and intestinal contents have been examined microscopically, as have the items found with the body. By the most recent estimates, at the time of his death, Utsi was 5 feet 3 inches tall, he weighed about 110 pounds, and he was about 45 years of age. Because the body was covered in ice shortly after his death, it had only partially deteriorated. So it's interesting because this Wikipedia article disputes one piece of information that appeared in the New York Times trilobite. At one point, it was thought that Utsi was the oldest tattooed human mummy yet discovered. But in 2018, tattoos were discovered on nearly contemporaneous Egyptian mummies. Many of his tattoos originally went unnoticed, since they are difficult to see with the naked eye. But in 2015, researchers photographed the body using non-invasive multispectral techniques to capture images on different light wavelengths that are imperceptible by humans, revealing the remainder of his tattoos. This next New York Times trilobite features the work of Scott Bobeck. He is an ecologist, herpetologist, and professor of biology at Dickinson College. He co-leads Project Rattlecam, a website and live stream showing the den of hundreds of rattlesnakes. Posted in the New York Times on January 17, 2025, we learn that rain-collecting rattlesnakes give new meaning to thirst trap. A new study reveals the surprising ways rattlesnakes have evolved to collect water in the desert. You are in a desert and dying of thirst. All of a sudden, storm clouds appear overhead, and the sky starts to spit tiny drops of liquid. How would you quickly make the most of the potentially life-saving precipitation? Oh, one more thing. You don't have any hands. Prairie rattlesnakes have evolved an easy solution to this problem. They simply coil up and turn themselves into rain-collecting pancakes. It is a behavior that is seen in several different species of snakes, said Scott Bobeck, a herpetologist and ecologist at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania. But most of that information has been very anecdotal. After all, rattlesnakes don't like being found, and precipitation in arid environments is infrequent. If Dr. Bobeck and his colleagues wanted to study the rain harvesting phenomenon, they realized they'd have to make it rain. With garden sprinklers and video cameras at a well-known rattlesnake hibernaculum just outside Steamboat Springs, Colorado, Dr. Bobeck and his team recorded nearly 100 snakes reacting to simulated rainfall. That allowed them to quantify the behavior and break it into stages. Not only did they observe snakes drinking off their own flattened bodies, as well as the ground, but they also saw snakes lean over and take sips off their neighbors. They also found that snakes in large aggregations were more likely to drink off other snakes than those in small clusters were. Some of the aggregations are literally massive, said Dr. Bobeck, an author of a study describing the behavior in the journal Current Zoology, published at the end of 2024. So many snakes all coiling together that it essentially creates a carpet of snakes. All of this suggests that warmth and protection may not be the only benefits for rattlesnakes that den together. Interestingly, the scientists also watched as some rattlesnakes shifted their coiled bodies out over ledges, like a cantilever, to create a horizontal rain-collecting platform across uneven ground. The snakes also sometimes tipped their entire coiled bodies forward, coaxing the water toward their mouths, as we might with a bowl to consume that last slurp of tomato soup. Most mysteriously of all, about 12 of the snakes appeared to drink water that was landing on their heads, and that was being channeled to their mouths through some unknown mechanism. "We don't know what's going on there," Dr. Bobak said. None of this would be possible without a curious and microscopic arrangement on the rattlesnake's scales. The scales are hydrophobic enough to make water droplets bead up, but hydrophilic enough to keep them from rolling right off the reptiles. "There are equivalent examples in plants," said Konrad Rykachevsky, a mechanical engineer at Arizona State University who was not involved in this study. "Go look at rose petals after it rains. You'll see large droplets sticking to it." In a 2019 study, Konrad Rykachevsky showed that desert rattlesnakes possessed this rain-catching ability, while king snakes, which live in the same areas but have smoother scales, do not. Rykachevsky called the new research very cool, but he wasn't as sure about whether the snakes' heads have water-guiding channels, similar to what have been shown on Texas horned lizards. He's also in no hurry to find out. "I mean, a dead rattlesnake can bite you still, right?" he laughed. Gordon Schuett, an evolutionary ecologist at Georgia State University and a co-author of the study with Dr. Rykachevsky, said that he had seen rain harvesting behavior many times in the field, but the considerable sample size and detail of the new study are what make it outstanding. In the end, Dr. Bobak is hopeful that the image of rattlesnakes peacefully sipping water off each other could remind more people that these animals are social beings with intimate behaviors and more complexity than we've traditionally given them credit for. "We've got this video of the snakes drinking off each other's heads, and it's like the cutest thing in the world," Dr. Bobak said. "They're practically kissing each other." Dr. Rykachevsky, formerly of MIT, is an associate professor in the Fulton School of Engineering at ASU. The focus of his research is Andy, the world's first walking, sweating mannequin. Andy is being used to find ways to measure and mitigate heat exposure risks to humans. Additional information is available about him on the AZ PBS Arizona Now program, dated August 1st, 2024. This New York Times trilobite, "Rain-Collecting Rattlesnakes Give New Meaning to Thirst Trap," was posted on January 17th, 2025. Now we turn to advances in the December 2024 issue of Scientific American. First, from the Department of Biomechanics, "Goofy Running. A silly-looking strategy lets birds pick up the pace." When humans want to move fast, barring speed walking races, we pick up our feet. But when birds need to get somewhere quickly without flying, they tend to always keep one foot on the ground, leading to a strange-looking gait that scientists call grounded running. "Most people won't even probably realize that they've seen a bird use grounded running," says Pasha von Bijlert, an evolutionary biomechanics graduate student at Utrecht University and Naturalis Biodiversity Center in the Netherlands. "Some of the times that you see a bird walking in a weird way, they're actually not walking, they're running. You can tell from the fact that they're bouncing." Grounded running in birds has puzzled scientists because humans mimicking the behavior usually use quite a bit more energy to achieve a running pace than we do with our habitual rapid movement style, called aerial running. But research by von Bijlert and his colleagues in Science Advances finds that birds aren't foolish for using grounded running, even though they may look silly. For the study, the scientists use a computer model of a common emu to show that the bird's posture makes grounded running more efficient than aerial running at certain speeds. By varying virtual emu's leg muscle and tendon anatomy, the simulations showed two strategies for reducing energy expenditure during faster movement: either keeping legs relatively straight during the running cycle or keeping one foot on the ground as much as possible. Humans take the first route, but birds can't, so they use grounded running instead. Humans asked to run in a crouched position will instinctively switch to grounded running as well. Give it a try if you're interested. If we think about bird locomotion through a human lens, then grounded running seems like a really weird and kind of dumb way to do something because it seems really energetically costly, says Armida R. Manofsadeh at Yale University. It's actually a pretty smart thing to do when you have the anatomy of a bird. Von Bischlert says the research may also inform scientists' understanding of birds' long-lost ancestors, dinosaurs. He suspects that especially dinosaurs that are closer relatives of birds, such as the petite velociraptors, might have chased down their prey like nightmare agents of the Ministry of Silly Walks. But more simulations are needed to determine whether bipedal dinosaurs, including the fearsome Tyrannosaurus rex, also might have practiced grounded running. The scientist adds that she hopes the new research reminds scientists to be curious about how other species experience life on Earth. If we try to interpret the diversity of animal locomotion through a human-centric lens, she says, we are going to miss out on lots of really cool and equally viable ways of moving around the world. This article, Goofy Running, was posted by Megan Bartles. And from Neuroscience, echo chamber. Brains can be trained to see sound. Human echolocation has at times allowed people to ride bikes or play basketball, despite being completely blind from a very young age. These echolocators typically perceive their environment by clicking sharply with their tongues and listening to differences in the sounds reflected off objects. Brain imaging studies reveal that expert echolocators display responses to sound in their brain's primary visual region, and researchers have speculated that long-term input deprivation could lead to visual regions being repurposed. There's been this strong tradition to think of the blind brain as different, that it's necessary to have gone through that sensory loss to have this neuroplasticity, says Laura Toller, a neuroscientist at Durham University in England. Toller co-led a 2021 study showing that both blind and sighted people could learn echolocation with just 10 weeks of training. For more recent work in the journal Cerebral Cortex, she and her colleagues examined the brain changes underlying these abilities. After training, both blind and sighted people displayed responses to echoes in their visual cortex, a finding that challenges the belief that primary sensory regions are wholly sense-specific. The researchers trained 14 sighted and 12 blind people for between 2 and 3 hours twice a week over 10 weeks. They started by teaching participants to produce mouth clicks, then trained them on 3 tasks. The first 2 involved judging the size or orientation of objects. The 3rd involved navigating virtual mazes, which participants moved through with the help of simulated click plus echo sounds tied to their positions. Both groups improved on all the tasks. This study adds a significant contribution to a growing body of evidence that this is a trainable, non-exotic skill that's available to both blind and sighted people, says Santani Deng, a psychologist at the Smith Kettlewell Eye Research Institute in San Francisco, who studies echolocation and braille. During brain scans before and after training, participants also performed a task that involved recognizing mazes with and without click echoes. After training, both groups showed increased auditory cortex activation in response to sound in general, as well as higher gray matter density in auditory areas. Most surprisingly, after training, both blind and sighted participants also showed visual cortex activation in response to audible echoes. We weren't sure if we could get this result in sighted people, so it was really rewarding to see it, Toller says. She suspects that rather than just processing visual data, this brain area takes in information from varied senses that aid spatial understanding. 3 months after the 2021 study, a follow-up survey found that 83% of blind participants who had learned echolocation reported improvements in independence and well-being. The researchers are working on disseminating the training more widely, Toller says. It's a powerful sensory tool for people with vision impairments. This article written by Simon Macken. From the double issue, December 14, December 28, 2024 issue of Science News, the Department of Environment. Do dying satellites harm Earth's sky? Burning debris may have ripple effects on atmospheric chemistry, by Carolyn Gramling. Earth's space junk may be wreaking havoc on the stratosphere. The rapid surge in satellite mega constellations is connecting much of the world to broadband internet. But each year, hundreds of those satellites die, burning up in the atmosphere as they fall. And each year, more and more satellites are being launched to replace them. The dying satellites don't just wink out into the ether. Each one leaves a bit of itself behind. The satellite's fiery death throes, along with the steep rise in the number of rocket launches, are adding a glut of ozone-destroying and climate-altering pollutants to the stratosphere, researchers say. What that means for the planet's atmospheric chemistry, including its ultraviolet light-shielding ozone layer, isn't yet clear, but scientists are racing to find out. The launches are growing so quickly, says Daniel Murphy, an atmospheric scientist at the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration's Chemical Sciences Laboratory in Boulder, Colorado. In the last couple of years, there have been roughly 500 re-entry events per year, he says, and people are talking about 10,000 in the not-too-distant future. That's about one an hour. So we'd like to understand the implications as soon as possible. Currently, there are about 10,000 active satellites in orbit around the planet. Two-thirds of these 10,000 satellites belong to Starlink, SpaceX's mega constellation. Another 630 are part of London-based Eutelsat OneWeb. Other internet projects intend to catch up quickly. In August, China launched the first 18 satellites for its Chulfan, or Thousand Sails, constellation, ultimately planned to comprise at least 12,000 satellites. Another planned Chinese project, known as Honghu 3, aims to link up to 10,000 satellites. By some estimates, there may be as many as 100,000 satellites in near-Earth orbit by the 2030s, with possibly 500,000 circling the planet in the decades to follow. These internet satellites are disposable by design. They may serve a few years in a constellation network before being decommissioned, sunk into a lower orbit until they ultimately fall to a fiery death through the sky. Each disintegrating satellite injects metals into the atmosphere, many of which are metals either not typically found there or ones that are being added in much greater abundances than are naturally introduced. The first step to understanding the scope of the problem is identifying the traces of burned-up spacecraft and whether those traces are comparable or even detectable against the background of natural meteorite debris from space. That research is just getting started. In 2023, Murphy and colleagues presented definitive evidence that metals specifically from spacecraft, rather than just natural sources, were indeed aloft in the stratosphere, the layer of atmosphere extending from 6 to 20 kilometers above Earth's surface. Stratospheric particles of sulfuric acid in the upper atmosphere over the Arctic turned out to contain over 20 different elements consistent with spacecraft production. Those elements, Murphy says, included niobium and hafnium, both refined from mineral ores for use in heat-resistant alloys. Other metals, such as lithium, lead, aluminum, and copper, which could be present naturally, were found in abundances far exceeding what might organically waft in via cosmic dust. And the evidence of erstwhile spacecraft is accumulating. From 2022, scientists tracked a stratospheric rise in pollutants corresponding to the rapid rise in satellite launches. Emissions of aluminum and nitrogen oxides from satellite re-entries nearly doubled from 3.3 billion grams in 2020 to 5.6 billion grams in 2022. Atmospheric chemist Connor Barker of University College London and colleagues reported in April in Vienna at a meeting of the European Geophysical Union. By 2022, re-entry inputs of nitrogen oxides, they found, were equivalent to about a third of the natural inputs of the gases from meteors, and aluminum oxide inputs were surprisingly natural inputs by a factor of 7. Pollutant emissions from rocket launches are also on the rise, Barker's team found. Propellant consumption nearly doubled from 2020 to 2022, from 38 billion grams to 67 billion grams. Those launch emissions can include pollutants such as black carbon, nitrogen oxides, carbon monoxide, aluminum oxide, and a variety of chlorine gases. The spacecraft debris could have a variety of ripple effects through the chemistry of the stratosphere. It could spell bad news for the ozone layer in particular. Aluminum oxide, for example, is a byproduct of the oxidation during re-entry of aluminum-based spacecraft components, says Jose Ferreira, an aerospace engineer at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And we know that aluminum oxides are catalysts for ozone depletion. This new threat to the ozone layer is particularly frustrating in the wake of the success of the Montreal Protocol, a 1987 agreement to ban the production and emissions of known ozone-destroying chemicals. By 2016, the annual hole in the ozone layer that forms over Antarctica was already showing signs of healing, on track to completely close up within about 50 years. There are a myriad other ways that spacecraft pollutants might tinker with the atmosphere's complex chemical brew, Murphy says. Soot emitted from rocket engines absorbs solar energy, which can warm the atmosphere. Copper and other metals released during the incineration of spacecraft, wiring, and alloys are known to be powerful catalysts for chemical reactions in the atmosphere. Among other things, those metals could promote the creation of the tiny particles that act as the seeds of clouds. There's not much direct information on which of these reactions might already be happening. The data that do exist are destined for computer simulations that track the life cycle of these pollutants and their interactions in the atmosphere. Murphy's team is also planning more flights in 2025 to continue tracking the growing inventory of spacecraft debris. Ferreira is considering ways to incorporate an environmental impact assessment into the design phase of space missions. If we identify upfront that a component or a chemical will be detrimental to the atmosphere, we can either find an alternative or invest in research into more environmentally friendly options, he says. For now, the question of impacts from the scattered stuff of satellites is so new that there hasn't yet been much funding to address it, Murphy says. But he adds, I think it needs to happen fast. It'd be really good to know these things before these satellites are built and launched. This summary in the Department of Environment in the double issue, December 14th, December 28th, Science News, explores Do dying satellites harm Earth's sky? Burning debris may have ripple effects on atmospheric chemistry. From the Department of Planetary Science, Uranus made a weird first impression. Some of Uranus's known oddities may be due to bad timing. When Voyager 2 flew by in 1986, the probe spotted intense radiation belts and lack of plasma in Uranus's magnetosphere, the magnetic fields that surround planets. Turns out Uranus may have been in an unusual state, scientists reported on November 11th in Nature Astronomy. An analysis of Voyager 2 data from months before the flyby revealed that intensifying pressure from the solar wind would have compressed the magnetosphere, which could account for the weird flyby observations. Uranus is in the state in which the probe found it. There's a photo from the flyby about 4% of the time. The team calculates, so much of what's known about the magnetosphere probably isn't typical. Posted by Lisa Grossman. Science stats. Traffic may threaten bees. Tens of millions of bees are estimated to be killed each day by vehicles, and that's just in the western United States. The findings, which were reported November 7th in the journal Sustainable Environment, show how cars may be contributing to the widespread loss of bees, essential pollinators of both wild plants and a third of the world's crops. Scientists have documented the ongoing insect apocalypse, in part by counting dead insects along roadsides, but such studies have focused on forested landscapes and are often biased toward larger species. Bee diversity, however, is highest in arid, more open regions, and most bees are tiny, just 2 to 25 millimeters long. Evolutionary ecologist Joseph Wilson of Utah State University and colleagues decided to investigate bee deaths. They attached sticky paper to the bumpers of mid-size vehicles and drove stretches of highway, paved roads with slower speeds, and unpaved roads during daylight hours when bees are known to be active. The team undertook 29 trips around Utah in spring and summer, traveling more than 9,400 kilometers, and identified struck bees down to the genus level. Every trip resulted in at least one bee fatality, with representatives of 15 genera. One car driving between Salt Lake City and Moab might kill 50 to 175 bees, the researchers estimate. Based on traffic data from the Utah Department of Transportation, that amounts to several million fatalities when scaled to the 94,000 cars traveling that route each day. Millions more cars make up Utah's daily traffic, and similar road trips occur in nearby states. So the total estimate of bees killed each day in the region is probably in the tens of millions, the team concludes. This posted by Amanda Height. And a teaser. An app could help you lucid dream. If you want to have a dream where you know you're dreaming, you might be in luck. A phone app, still in testing, seems to boost users' odds of having lucid dreams. Before bed, the app has users listen to a specific sound, such as a series of beeps, and practice associating that cue with a keen awareness of their thoughts and body. When the app plays that sound 6 hours later, it's meant to reactivate that self-awareness, coaxing sleeping users to become lucid mid-dream. These types of sensory cues have proved fairly effective for inducing lucid dreams in sleep studies. But a researcher usually tracks someone's sleep to play sounds during the REM stage, when lucid dreams are most likely. New experiments show that a rough approximation of the technique using an app can promote lucid dreaming at home, researchers reported in the October issue of Consciousness and Cognition. Neuroscientist Karen Conkley of Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, and colleagues built and tested the app. In one experiment, 19 people used it every night for a week. During the previous week, the group reported an average of 0.74 lucid dreams. During the week of app use, that ramped up to an average of 2.11 lucid dreams. But it wasn't completely clear that the app's sound cues led to that increase. So the team ran another experiment with 112 people. Everyone got lucidity-triggering sounds from training while they slept the first night. But on the second night, the app switched things up. Only 40 people heard sounds from training while they slept. Another 35 got new sounds. The final 37 heard no sounds. The first night, 17% of participants reported lucid dreams. The second night, people who heard training sounds kept up that rate of lucid dreaming, while just 5% of the people in the other two groups had lucid dreams, hinting that the real sound cues were indeed behind the app's effectiveness. This posted by Maria Temming. And from Notebook, 50 years ago, surface features of a distant star. Thanks to high-speed photography and modern data processing, astronomers are beginning to be able to suppress the effects of a star twinkling. The star involved is one of the most prominent in the sky, Big Red Betelgeuse. What we found are large-scale hot and cold regions that may be convection currents in the star's atmosphere. Update: powerful ground and space-based telescopes have since let scientists observe the surfaces of giant stars in the Milky Way, including Betelgeuse and R. Doradus, in even greater detail. Those observations confirmed that surface spots are related to convection, bubbles of hot and cold gas rising and sinking in a star's atmosphere. In November, scientists reported the first close-up image of a star outside of our galaxy. Using the Very Large Telescope in Chile, astronomers spotted a star puffing out dust and gas in the Large Magellanic Cloud, a small galaxy that orbits our own. That suggests the star, named WOHG64, may be dying. And these stories: traffic may threaten bees, an app could help you lucid dream, and surface features of a distant star also appear in the double December issue of Science News. And then we have an update on bats from the Department of Animals. Why do scientists put bats on treadmills? Well, giving bloodsuckers a workout sheds light on metabolism, by Susan Milius. Vampire bats have become such specialized bloodsuckers that they metabolize food more like some blood-feeding flies than like other mammals, a new study shows. The common vampire bat doesn't stick to flying. It also scurries along the ground to steal blood from cattle, horses, and other mammals. That scurrying behavior led researchers, who were curious about bat metabolism, coax vampires to run on a treadmill, at least for a little while. Up to 60% of the carbon dioxide the bats exhaled during a workout came from metabolizing fuel other than the carbohydrates or fats that typically power a running mammal, the team reported in the November 6th issue of Biology Letters. Instead, much of the energy came from a recent high-protein meal of cow blood. The gases contained telltale traces from amino acids, the building blocks of proteins. The ratio of carbon dioxide exhaled to oxygen used stayed steady as researchers pushed the treadmill pace from walking to running. That steadiness is a sign that bats weren't fueling their exertions the usual mammal way. Gas ratios typically change as exercise gets more strenuous, and mammals shift from burning mostly lipids to relying more on carbs. Vampire bats power along by metabolizing a recent blood meal, much like blood-feeding tsetse flies. That's a first for mammals, says study co-author Ken Welch, an ecological physiologist at the University of Toronto. It makes sense to Welch that any ancestral ability to use sugar byproducts and fats weakened over time in vampire bats. Yet such heavy reliance on amino acids, which aren't as easy to access quickly, means the bats could be more susceptible to starvation. And there is a photo of a bat on a treadmill. This from the Department of Animals in the double issue of Science News. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.